VCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
And thank you for joining us on Crosstalk here on VCY America. As we turn to the book of Psalms, chapter 8, verses 3 and 4, it says, "When I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon, the stars, which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him?" This month of July, we are certainly remembering the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 launch, the landing on the moon, July 20th, 1969. Last week, we had this fascinating interview with Bill Federer, and we're looking at the faith of the astronauts in particular, scripture quoted on the moon, even communion served on the moon. Today, we're going to turn our eyes to the heavens and look at the moon itself, as well as the stars and sky. And joining us, we'd like to welcome to our studios Dr. Danny Faulkner. He has a Master of Science in Physics, Master of Arts degree, as well as a PhD in astronomy. He taught at the University of South Carolina, Lancaster, for over 26 years. Serves as the editor of the Creation Research Society Quarterly, has published over 100 papers in various journals. He's a researcher and author, speaker for Answers in Genesis, and the author of many, many books, including The Expanse of Heaven, Where Creation and Astronomy Intersect. He's in our area this week as he's one of the featured speakers at the Creation Research Society Conference at Concordia University in Mequon. But Dr. Faulkner, nice to have you here in studio.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm fascinated when I look at the night sky in particular, how we operate a camp about 3 hours from here. Here we have the concrete jungle, a lot of city lights, but when we get to the camp setting, it is just a marvel to see the expanse of the sky. I'm fascinated by the stars, the planet. The darker it gets, the more it seems that one is able to certainly see. But as I am fascinated, just a layman, what fascinates an astronomer? What fascinates you when you look at the sky?
Oh, well, I think the same thing you're talking about. I, from time to time, get to a dark location, such as Grand Canyon in Arizona, some observatories in remote places, and I just like going outside, even at the observatory, just drinking in the sky, mm-hmm. Spending time with the binoculars, laying down on the ground. That's what got me hooked when I was a child, and it still thrills me. Now, of course, as an astronomer, I appreciate the science behind it all. There's a lot of physics involved, and we can see and understand those things, but you can combine all of that and add to it the fact that I see the hand of the Creator.
Yeah,
we have here, and he's an awesome God, and he's made a fantastic world around it, just chock full of things for us to explore. That's exciting.
There's been a lot of focus, of course, this month with the 50th anniversary of the launch of Apollo 11, the moon landing as well, and a lot of emphasis then on the moon. Just for setting our foundation, on what day did God create the moon?
On day four.
Is there any hint as to its age by looking at the moon and examining the moon?
Not directly. I mean, you got to make a raft of assumptions, and people try to date it four and a half billion years old. But I've looked at some things on the moon that suggest a vastly younger age than that. So you can go a lot of different directions. We're talking about past processes, after all, mm-hmm. and it depends what assumptions you want to make. But I see evidence going either way. But I do believe the moon to be very young, a matter of a little over 6,000 years, I think.
One of the things that have been used to talk about the age of the moon is lunar dust. Now, some creationists will point to this dust and say, this is a great argument for a young moon, and others say, hey, hold on a second, it may not be such a good argument. What about moon dust? Is this a valid assessment, or is there problems with that?
I'm in the second group. I'm saying, hold on, folks. Here's the problem. Back in the 1950s, a guy named Peterson did some studies trying to evaluate how much meteoritic material was being added to the moon each year. And what he did is he was trying to evaluate how much meteoritic influx there was on the Earth's atmosphere each day, each year. And he found an amazingly high rate, and when you extrapolate that over billions of years, there should have been hundreds, maybe thousands of feet of dust, because when it hits, it pulverizes, it makes this thin dust. Turns out the dust was only a tiny fraction of an inch. It was like an eighth of an inch or something like this. And so the argument is, well, if you've got all this dust accumulating over billions of years, then it should be should be hundreds or thousands of feet thick. It isn't, so therefore it must be young. The problem is Peterson's measurements from 60 years ago were indirect, very indirect. And eventually, by the late, certainly the 1970s, we had ways to directly measure that. And it turns out the rate that Peterson measured was fantastically too large. And when you get the correct rate, it indicates that the not really a problem even for billions of years. So I, until new data comes along that suggests otherwise, I'm telling people this is probably not a good argument. I'd wave people off of that one.
So what is a good argument to talk about the age of the year, the moon?
Okay, one of them would be the interaction between the Earth and the moon. People are familiar with the tides on the Earth, but people don't know this, but the Earth raises tides on the moon as well. That's the reason why we believe the moon orbits and rotates and revolves at the same rate, keeping one face towards the Earth all the time. And we also know that there's a very subtle reaction. I can't go all the physics here about how this happens, but with time, the Earth's rotation gradually slows and the moon slowly spirals away. We've measured how far it's moving away from us. It's about 4 centimeters a year, which is about, an inch and a half or so. Doesn't sound like much. We've measured that, by the way, with some of the reflectors left on the lunar surface by the Apollo astronauts. But when you start looking at this, you find that in the past, when the moon was much closer to the Earth, there would have been a much stronger interaction. The functional form is inverse sixth power of the distance, which is, if you know anything about mathematics, that's a very steep function. So we know that the physics pretty well on that front. All we have to do is just do the calculations based on the measurements. And you end up with a pretty stiff upper limit of about 1.2, 1.3 billion years for the age of the Earth and the Moon. At that time, the Earth and the Moon would have been in contact with each other. And furthermore, sometime before that, after that, like maybe 900 million years or so ago, a billion years ago, the tides on the Earth would have been a mile high. You know, here in Wisconsin, you might have had beachfront property twice a day. So no one believes the tides are ever that big. Mm-hmm. And this is based on very good science, very good measurements, understood physics. And so that would suggest to me that the moon and the Earth must have been in existence for far less than even a billion years. Doesn't automatically mean it's 6,000 years, but it would eliminate anything longer than that. And that seems to be the problem because for the evolutionists, because they believe the moon is 4.5 billion years old. And they do a song and dance to get around this problem, but I think it's a very good argument for the recent origin of the moon.
How does the moon impact our oceans?
Oh, how does it? You talking about the tides?
Yeah, the tides.
Oh, okay. Well, the tides.
What is the functionality that?
Well,
causes
it causes it to go up and down every day, but it also that causes some cleansing, as it turns out, flushing in, flushing out. It estuaries and so forth rely upon this. A lot of animals and plants rely upon this very critically for their life cycles, for their mating cycles. If the tides were not there, we would have a very different world. We have a lot of stagnant water in places. Mm-hmm. So the tides are critically important. The moon is I've grown to realize it's a unique in the solar system. There's no body like it. The more I learn about it, the more fascinated I am with it. For the longest time, I didn't really care about the moon that much. It wasn't that interesting, I didn't think, but I see design all over it. It's so different from anything else we see out there.
Now, so we have the impact then with the high tide, low tide. What about during the time of Noah, the universal flood upon the Earth?
Yeah.
What kind of impact did the moon have at that time when everything's covered by water?
Okay, that gets tricky. One of the ideas, and I think it bears out, is if you have no continents in the way, which you would have once the flood really gets going, you're going to end up with water, lots of it, and you would end up with this tidal surge twice a day. The Earth spins around, and as it does, you're causing high and low tides, unimpeded by the continents. And so it's believed that that could have caused a lot of surging twice a day, high, low, high, low. And that could have played a very important role in how rock layers were laid down, how water stripped stuff. I do a raft trip every year. Poor me, right? It's in Grand Canyon. We do it for a week, and we do geology by day and astronomy by night. And one of the things that keeps coming up, and the person doing the interpretation for the geology end from a creation and flood perspective, is the influence of the tides, because we do believe during the time of the flood it would have played a very important role in what we see in the world today.
Dr. Danny Faulkner with us here today from Answers in Genesis, and we're taking a look at the heavens with a special emphasis on the moon here today. The Bible refers to the moon as the lesser light. Some have stated, well, the moon doesn't emit light. Is this a contradiction in Scripture?
I don't think so at all. Sometimes we say the moon reflects the light of the sun. That's not quite correct. It scatters it. I'm looking around here at the studio, and I don't see any mirrors. Well, I see a glass over there, but the stuff around me, it's scattering light. That's how we see it. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of light sources that are not really light sources. Some people try to say, well, it has to have its own light source. But the problem is skylights. We call them lights. There's not a bit of light in it. In itself, it's letting sunlight through. Oftentimes, I open the blinds up in the house to let light in on sunny days so I can see what's going on. It's my own natural lighting coming in. When you do photography, many times, or videoing or movies, they have light reflectors to inside. They do this. They do it outside as well, using the light of the sun that reflect off these panels so that you can see actors' faces. If they're standing in shade, it doesn't show up at all. So we use all sorts of light sources that don't have any light at all. They simply reflect or scatter the light that falls on them. So there's no contradiction. Not at all, unless you want to start claiming that all sorts of light sources out there really aren't light sources. And we're pretty sloppy if that's the case.
We also hear a phrase called the dark side of the moon. Mm-hmm. Is there a dark side of the moon?
Yes and no. that term was coined probably in the 19th century, I'm going to guess. The moon rotates and revolves at the same rate. I mentioned that a moment ago, and that means that one faces towards the Earth at all times. So while we mapped the front side and a little bit around the edges a long time ago, we had no idea what the backside of the moon looked like. Not until 60 years ago when the first spacecraft took a few photographs of it when it went past the moon. Of course, we've mapped it extensively now with orbiting spacecraft. And so people called it the dark side of the moon in the sense that it's unknown. At one time in the 19th century, people referred to Africa as being the dark continent. It's because it hadn't been explored by Westerners, and they had no maps. They didn't know what was there. Victoria Falls was discovered pretty late. Mm. All sorts of cute, cool things in Africa because it was totally unknown. Mm-hmm. So the moon, every part of it gets lit up. You know, it's not like it's perpetually dark, and people misunderstand that. It's referring to the unknown part. We really can't call that today because even though we can't see it from Earth, we do know what it looks like.
The moon has been called a natural satellite of the Earth. Is that an accurate description?
Absolutely. We astronomers get pretty persnickety about this. I try to police it as much as I can. The moon is the name of the natural satellite that orbits the Earth. And a satellite is something artificial or natural that orbits a planet. We have thousands of man-made satellites that orbit the Earth, but one natural one, and its name is the Moon. Unfortunately, we talk about other planets like Jupiter. I was looking at it last night. It's got four large satellites, and we sometimes call them moons. It'd be like, you know, you got a friend, your favorite friend's name is Bob. You meet a few other people named Steve and Dave and Jim, and you call them Bob too because they're Bob-like in that sense. So it's very confusing, and you really shouldn't call the satellites of the other planets natural satellites. You shouldn't call them moons because that's a proper name for the Earth's satellite.
So what do you call them?
Satellites.
Okay, just satellites.
Just satellites, yeah.
Okay.
That's the preferred term among astronomers. I'm probably fighting a losing battle with the general public.
Yeah, very good. But we're just seconds away from a break. Dr. Danny Faulkner is with us today from Answers in Genesis. Their website, answersingenesis.org, and also has his hand in lots of creation ministry and speaking at a conference here this weekend, even speaking this evening. We'll give you some information for those of you in southeast Wisconsin pertaining to that issue. This is Crosstalk on VCY America, taking a look to the heavens today with emphasis on the moon. We'll be right back.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, president of the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, have you ever seen that bumper sticker of a fish with legs? What's that all about?
Chris, that bumper sticker is a direct insult to Christians and the God of Christianity. It's a perversion of the Christian symbol of the fish, which has been in place ever since the early church days. It's interesting to note that this has almost become a religious symbol with evolution. We've been saying for a long time that evolution is a religion, and now they have their religious symbol. Chris, they have to have symbols because they really just don't have any evidence that evolution has occurred. Evolution is not a science. It's the religion of naturalism, the idea that there is no supernatural God behind it all. At least that's how I see it from a back-to-Genesis perspective.
To learn more about creation, get our free DVD called That's a Fact. Visit our web store at icr.org/store and use the promo code FACT at the checkout when ordering your That's a Fact DVD.
This is Crosstalk on VCY America. Dr. Danny Faulkner with us here today. And as I mentioned, he's speaking at a conference at the Concordia University. It's the Creation Research Society Conference. And Dr. Faulkner, you've been involved with the Creation Research Society for some time.
Yes.
Tell us about that involvement.
Okay. I've been on the board for about 15 years, board of directors. It's been my pleasure to serve there. I was the editor of the Quarterly. We are one of our publications. I recently handed that off to Tim Claria from Institute of Creation Research. So I'm wrapping that up and starting his new tenure. but the society was begun back in 1963 by 10 influential men. One of them, hopefully your listeners will know, Henry Morris.
Oh, yes.
Very famous creationist, one of the co-founders of the modern creation movement. And he was one of the founders of the of Creation Research Society. We're a bit different from other organizations. We're a professional society or just a society of creationists. If you're really passionate about creationists, even though you're not a scientist, then you ought to join. Mm. And we promote research. That's what we're doing with our meeting this week, Friday and Saturday. The Concordia campus in Mequon will be having 30-minute presentations. These are not polished, finished results, but these are results, works in progress. Mm. And so it's like any other science meeting. We got a lot of cutting-edge things. If you want to meet the researchers and find out what they're working on, this is the meeting for you.
And also tonight, you're going to be speaking at a local church, Fox River Christian Church in Waukesha. Did the universe really begin with a Big Bang?
Yeah. The answer is no. But I gave it away, didn't I?
Oh, okay.
I'll be talking about what the Big Bang model is. Mm-hmm. I'll be explaining some problems with it scientifically and also biblically. I don't think it works. I have two reasons for rejecting it. It's not biblical, and I think the scientific problems are there.
And I understand that starting at 7 o'clock this evening, and then later after dark, you have something planned.
Yeah, we've got some telescopes. The weather is amazingly clear. So we plan to look at least at Jupiter and Saturn. Who knows what else? But the door's open at 6. We have some other programs going on, a little telescope workshop somebody's doing, some meet and greet. So while I speak at 7, the door's open at 6. People may want to come early for that.
Great. Again, that's Fox River Christian Church for admission this evening.
Mm-hmm.
And location on Lonsdale Road in Waukesha. That's S46, West 24130. Lonsdale Road, Waukesha, Wisconsin, free admission, and begin your best being there then by 6 o'clock for some of the workshops and so forth going on. Dr. Faulkner speaking at 7, having some fellowship afterwards, and then taking a look to the heavens after that. Dr. Faulkner, we were just talking about the moon being a natural satellite of the Earth. In the same way, could one say that the Earth is a natural satellite of the Sun, or is there a contradiction?
Well, it's a different terminology. It's a great point. Students frequently ask me this question, so my teaching, I make a point of this now. A planet is a large object that orbits the Sun, and a satellite is an object, large or small, that orbits a planet. For instance, Triton is the largest satellite in the solar system. It orbits Saturn. It's actually larger than Mercury. So sometimes people would ask me, my students would ask me, well, why isn't Triton a planet? And I said, it's very simple. What does it orbit? Does it orbit the Sun or does it orbit a planet? So that's the way we make that division. And by the way, yes, Pluto is not a planet. We kind of demoted it back in 2006, and I still occasionally get people want to argue about it a little bit. But there are several reasons why we did. A couple of reasons. One of them, just it's too small. It's really too small to be a planet.
And does it orbit the Sun?
It does. But it's also orbited by 5 small objects, which are like satellites. That's interesting. We've now classified it as a minor planet, or, if you will, more colloquially, an asteroid.
Okay.
And these are small bodies. They're actually comets are the other small bodies of the solar system. And the count, I remember back when there were 2,000 asteroids, then there were 3, then there were 4. 1,000. Now there are, last I saw, I think 860,000. We're closing in on a million. Most of them are very tiny, you know, a mile or so across, or even less. Pluto is rather large. It's one of the largest of the asteroids, but it still is an asteroid.
Tell us about the surface of the moon.
Surface of the moon. Okay, it's rocky. And there are two basic types of rocks there. You may notice, particularly when the moon's full, you'll notice light areas and dark areas. Mm-hmm. And it gives that man in the moon appearance. And if you have a small telescope, you can even see it better at that phase. And the darker regions are made of a rock that is very similar to basalt on the Earth. It's not exact match chemically, but it's close enough that we can say it's a basalt. This is the volcanic rock. You see them in the Pacific Northwest, Hawaii, different places around them. Very beautiful rock, by the way. Mm. Very dark and dense. And the lighter regions on the moon are made of granite-type rocks. They're lighter in color. They're also less dense, and so they tend to be at a higher elevation. And the basalt at a lower elevation, we call the lighter regions the highlands. They're heavily cratered. And the dark regions, the basalt regions, we call those the maria. That's a Latin plural for seas. And the idea was 400 years ago, these smooth, dark areas might have been bodies of water. It turns out there's no water on the moon, but if there were, they would all collect in those lower regions. So they weren't too far off the mark.
Yeah. Are craters still forming on the moon?
Yes, not very quickly. We've actually seen a few form in recent years.
How did they form?
Impacts. Most of them are, if we think, formed from impacts. There are a few that were volcanic in origin, but most we think are impacts. We've seen a few small impacts that have occurred.
Objects that have hit the moon?
Mm-hmm. And we see, interesting enough, we see impacts, we see craters on every solid surface in the solar system, except for Io. It's the innermost large satellite of Jupiter, and that one has a lot of volcanic activity going on, so it's completely resurfacing it all the time. So any craters it has been long ago erased. The Earth has a few craters on it. The best example is probably Arizona Meteor Crater near Winslow, Arizona. Hmm. You ever been there? It's a neat place. I've been several times. It's really
a good
place. I just
got to the Grand Canyon for my first time this last year.
You need to go back.
Yes,
indeed. go on a raft trip with us.
Yeah, beautiful. It was just one of those things you just stand in awe looking at it.
You know, the first time I went out there over 20 years ago, I went to Grand Canyon, looked around. It was grand. It was wonderful. Mm-hmm. It was about what I expected, you know, in many respects. But I went to Meteor Crater, and I was totally unprepared. You go through the visitor center, you come around a corner, and then there it is through a big picture window, sunny day, and I gasped. It literally took my breath away. It was much bigger than I could have imagined. So I had weird reaction there. I gasped at something that was not nearly as big, but I wasn't expecting to look this big, as impressive as it was.
Some have stated that craters are an imperfection of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an accurate assessment? Do you agree with that?
I disagree with that. I think that people have their own ideas of perfection. They're trying to get back to the curse and the fall of man and so forth. But I don't view craters as being a problem. After all, it's a sterile world. There's nothing living there. Never has been anything living there. And I think many of the craters on the moon actually formed on day four when God formed the moon. And some of the other craters, I think, have happened since then. Some of them, I think, happened at the time of the flood. But I think most of them occurred during day four. And so other creationists disagree with me bringing up that very objection that you just brought up or mentioned. They think that craters are somehow an imperfection of some sort. But I disagree.
Think they're evidence of design?
I think they're evidence of creation. I don't know so much design, but you know, there's an interesting dimorphism, I'll call it that, on the moon. The near side is about 50% highland and maria. The dark side, the other side we never see from the Earth, mm-hmm. it's about 95% highland.
Interesting.
No other body in the solar system is quite like that. And I think what happened is those maria were formed by impacts that occurred about the time of the flood here on the Earth. And I like to say that the moon was, as I say, in military terms, collateral damage.
Yeah. I'd like to go back to Joshua chapter 10. You're familiar with the passage there.
Mm-hmm.
This is a battle of the children of Israel. We've got the Amorites there. And we speak of the sun standing still. And one can quickly go over that without recognizing that there's also a reference to the moon in mm-hmm. those passages. Let me just share the two verses from Joshua 10, 12, and 13. Then spake Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of the son of Israel, Sun, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is not this written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and hasted not to go down about a whole day. Comment on that passage. Did the sun stand still? Did the moon stay? I mean, did the rotation stop?
We can even date the time of the month that was in. If it says it was over top of Gibeon, it's probably noon. And if you see the Valley of Ajalon off to the west, that was probably a first quarter moon rising about noon, maybe in a gibbous phase, but very close to first quarter. So if you knew what year and month it was, you could tell what day it was if we knew that other precise part. But yeah, the moon and the sun did actually stop. Now, some people say, whoa, wait a minute. Are you saying that you're a geocentrist, that the earth sits still and everything goes around it? Well, no, not at all. As an astronomer, I frequently talk about sunrise and sunset, stars rising and setting, the moon rising and setting, because in a very real sense, the sun and the moon rise every day and set every day. They move across the sky every day. We astronomers use that terminology all the time. You ever been sitting at a plane getting ready to back away from the gate at an airport, and maybe you're reading something or looking at something, and your peripheral vision, there's another plane sitting next to you that starts to move? How do you know which plane is moving? Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm thinking, oh, we're moving. I didn't feel it. And I look over and it's they're moving. Mm-hmm. Other times I'm moving. When they start backing you away from the gate, it's done very gradually and you don't feel a thing. Very smooth motion. And that illustrates the problem with relative motion. All we ever observe is relative motion. We don't really have a good handle on what absolute motion is. And sometimes we try to get carried away with that. Many of the geocentrists try to argue absolute motion. But scientifically, we can't really determine what is actually moving because all we can measure is relative motion. Now, I happen to believe that the moon orbits this Earth every month, and I believe the Earth spins on its axis every day. But I have no problem saying that the sun stood still and the moon stood still in the sky for most of a day, because that's exactly how I would describe it if I were there. I wouldn't say, well, the Earth must have stopped rotating and all this kind of stuff. No, I just say they stopped in the sky. And some people try to milk too much out of this, try to be hyper-literal about the whole thing. It doesn't threaten Scripture, the authority of Scripture at all, to say that the moon and the sun stopped in the sky, because that's exactly what happened.
Dr. Danny Faulkner with us today. Of course, this past Saturday marked the commemoration, that 50th year of that Apollo spacecraft landing on the moon, man stepping out there on the moon. As years have gone by, there's been an increasing level of doubt that this really did happen, that those who will say this was staged, this is nothing more than a Hollywood production, if you will. What's your response to that, to the skepticism as to the moon landing?
I think it's nonsense. The first dive, well, there have always been people who kind of doubted this. But they really didn't get much traction until about 2001. There was a documentary I hadn't heard about until recently called "The Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon." Didn't have a lot of airtime. But about the same time, there was another one. I forget the name of the title now, but of the movie. But it ran on the Fox Network, not Fox News, but the Fox Network. Had a student of mine call me about a few minutes into the show and said, "Hey, would you mind watching this?" He apologized for calling me at home. I said, "I don't care. It's fine. Thank you for bringing it to my attention." We wanted to discuss it the next day. So I watched most of the movie, and many of the things they brought up in the movie I could easily explain. Some things were a little more technical. I have to do some digging, but many of them just like that. Again and again, I just could explain what really going on here. Mm-hmm. And I got the impression that the people who put the movie together were doing it as a prank just to see who they could fake out on this and come to believe. Like they talked about the shadows on the moon indicating two different light sources. I could tell instantly they drew their shadows wrong. They drew their lines wrong on the shadows. Mm-hmm. They talked about the waving of the flag on the moon. Well, every time that waved, as the astronauts were trying to drive this thing into the very thin soil we talked about earlier, and the thing had a wire around it and it was causing it to vibrate. They stopped moving the pole and it stopped doing that.
Let's come back to the issue after the break. This is Crosstalk on VCY America. Dr. Danny Faulkner is our guest. Back in just 1 minute here on the VCY America Network.
We live in a depraved world with sin and corruption all around us. There are many temptations to lure us away from our walk with the Lord. How do we stay clean, pure, and righteous in such a time? In Psalm 119, we are reminded of the importance of hiding God's Word in our heart to protect us from succumbing to sin. But memorization is difficult for many. This is why Thomas Meyer, known as the Bible Memory Man, has not only devoted many books of the Bible to memory, but he has also put together the King James Memorization Study Bible, where he breaks up every verse in the New Testament by phrases to assist in the scripture memory process. A helpful appendix also provides a list of important scriptures to memorize from sin to salvation in 10 verses. The Memory Study Bible New Testament is available for a donation of $20 or more by calling VCY 1-800-729-9829.
This is Crosstalk on VCY America. Dr. Danny Faulkner is our guest, and talking about, a look to the heavens with emphasis on the moon here today. In a moment, we'll be opening up phone lines, giving you opportunity to call in with your questions today, and we'll broaden it out just a little bit. Doesn't have to be just the moon, but certainly as it relates to the planets, the sun, the stars, we'll welcome those questions here as well. But Dr. Faulkner, we were just talking about the staged performance that we're hearing today in increasing levels of those who don't believe that what happened in 1969 actually did happen. Was Hollywood even capable of putting together something like that at that time?
Not really. No, the people, I think today they see all the special effects we have and all the animations you can do, computer animation, all mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. But this was a half century ago. I mean, my cell phone has far more computing power than the computers that they used to go to the moon back then. You certainly didn't have the capability to do the animations back then. People try to say, well, the government's way ahead, secret projects and stuff. No, it's not. This didn't exist back then. So it would have been a lot easier to go to the moon than fake it back then, as it turns out. Today, you probably could fake it pretty well. But people just don't think about the acronym there of imposing modern ability to do these things with what was going on back then.
And folks, some of you may have questions further on that very issue. By the way, Dr. Faulkner has authored the book, The Expanse of Heaven, Where Creation and Astronomy Intersect. He gets into, it's a hardcover, 400-page book, Ancient Cosmologies in the Bible, The Expanse of the Heavens, The Earth as a Planet, The Moon, there's a chapter there, Planets and Satellites of the Solar System, The Sun, Stars and Stellar Distances, The Milky Way, so much more in the book. And then there's different appendices in there, too. One is called, Is the Earth Flat? Yeah. It's an appendix on the total solar, there's an appendix on the total solar eclipse from 2017, and something I found fascinating as well, some color photographs that are in the book itself. And just want to make mention that the book normally retails for $24.99, but for a limited time, our VCY bookstore is offering this for just $19, plus any applicable tax or shipping. But it's available by phone for $19 by calling our VCY bookstore, 1-888-722-4829. 1-888-722-4829. Just ask for the book, The Expanse of Heaven, and they'll be able to help you out. Again, that's 1-888-722-4829. And Dr. Faulkner, I understand you have a new book coming out here in the very near future.
Yeah, it's about the Flat Earth movement, something I became aware of 3.5 years ago, and I've been studying it, fascinated with it. I've written a number of articles. I've spoken about it, and I've worked with a DVD with the Creation Guys recently on one. And I decided to collect my thoughts on this and put together a book. Master Books has it. I've seen they've laid it out for me. I've done some corrections on it. I think it's going to be out by the end of summer, September probably. I'm not sure the exact publication date, but it's called Falling Flat. That's the title, and it's got a subtitle as well. But this is an insidious movement out there, I believe, and it's kind of subsumed a lot of other things, such as the Apollo moon landing supposedly being a hoax. It's subsumed the geocentric movement in many respects, that we've already alluded to in an earlier point. So it's a timely book. I've written this book to give answers to people who are really looking for answers.
Well, folks, maybe you have questions and you'd like to ask them today. Our phone lines are open here to Crosstalk, 1-800-733-9829. That's 1-800-733-9829 here to Crosstalk. And if you have a question you'd like to ask of Dr. Faulkner as it pertains to his field of expertise, that is that of astronomy, we encourage you to pick up your phone, give us a call today, 800-733-9829. We hear the phrase once in a blue moon. What does that mean? Is a moon blue-like in appearance?
You know, That's an interesting story. I think it's supposed to refer to some rare atmospheric thing where the moon can appear kind of bluish. I've never seen anything like that, hence the expression being so rare. But, you know, there's something that was unleashed in the 60s. Somebody misunderstood something in an old almanac, and this thing was unleashed. And I taught it for years, and I found out better. A blue moon supposedly was two full moons in one calendar month, which happens like every other year or so. But it turns out that was kind of invented on the spot by mistake.
Interesting.
So I had to kind of change my teaching when I found out the truth on that one.
Very interesting. Okay. Let's go to the phone lines here today. We have Karen calling in from Hartford, Wisconsin. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. You may have already addressed this, and I might have missed it or not thoroughly heard. I have two questions. First of all, does the moon affect the tides? And if so, how does it do that? And the second question, it seems you alluded to the flood affecting the moon. And how did it do that?
Okay, we did talk about tides earlier, so we're going to have him do a brief recap because you can listen to the rebroadcast tonight. But very briefly, how the moon affected the tides and then also the correlation of the flood.
A little more detail than we said before. The moon, the gravity of the Earth acts on the moon, and the gravity of the moon acts on the Earth. Equal opposite reactions from Newton's third law of motion. But gravity is one thing, but this is what we call a differential force. The near side of the moon is pulled more than the far side of the moon, and the near side of the Earth is pulled by the moon more than the far side of the Earth. So it kind of stretches the Earth out and the moon out in a kind of like a football sort of shape. And the rocks can respond to a certain extent on that, but they can't do it all. So the oceans are free to slip around the Earth, and they pile up on either side of the Earth, giving you a high tide on either side. The atmosphere does the same thing, too. There's a slight high and low pressure every day. And the sun also raises tides on the Earth, even though its gravity is stronger than the moon's. The moon's tide is actually about twice that of the sun on the Earth. And so the moon's tides are stronger than the sun's tides. And so the second question was...
It had to do with the flood.
Oh, the flood. Some of the flood models we have today suggest that when the... When the continents were inundated, you didn't have any continents in anymore. The tides were allowed to run wild, more or less. And so you would have had a lot of violence going on, and that would have been heaped up in two places of the Earth, spun each day. We'd have high and low coming in. I think some people claim they can see that in some of the rock layers we see laid down, particularly early on in the flood.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Karen.
Explain it. Thanks.
Appreciate the call. Let's go next to Kevin. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Yes, my question is more of a fiscal responsibility type thing. I had read something quite a while ago, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but we had some Land Rovers on Mars, and the price tag was just millions and millions and millions of dollars. And the question I have is, at what point do we say, okay, we don't need to spend that kind of money having some Land Rovers on Mars trying to research it? And I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Well, that's a great question. And it's a fair question to ask. And as a taxpayer, I have to ask that question from time to time, too. I will point out that sending rovers and robotic spacecraft is a lot cheaper than sending people. I've been a real advocate for some time for robotic spacecraft. I think people get in the way. They have to take a lot of things like food and air and all that kind of stuff with them. Robots don't need that. So we can send a space probe to Mars and do everything an astronaut could do at a fraction of the cost. As expensive as an unmanned probe to Mars might be, you ought to look at the price tag on a manned mission to Mars. Mm. And the Trump administration right now is talking about returning to the moon as a stepping stone to go to Mars. They're talking about going to the moon within 5 years. I don't think that's going to happen, but that's... We'll see. And I have to question, you know, why go there? We went there 50 years ago because of part of the Cold War. It was nationalism, you know, got to beat the Soviets there. And that's over. That's 50 years ago. And we've been there. There's nothing really we don't need any resources there. Everything on the moon is pretty common on the Earth, actually. There is some science you can do, but I think robotic spacecraft can do that much better. So I like going to the moon. I like going to the Mars, but with robotic spacecraft instead. And it's a fraction of the cost. I know it's millions, but it's not billions we'd have if people got in the way. And Mars is a fascinating object. And I don't know if the person asking this question is a Christian, a creationist, but turns out there are a lot of stuff we can find on the moon and on Mars that could say something about the age of either and the creation of either. So don't think it's all being done in the name of evolution. There's some actually good creation science you can actually get applications from all this. So I'm bullish on that front.
Let's hit Doug next. Doug, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, thanks, Jim. And Dr. Faulkner, I have a question about something. I don't know if you've thought of this, but you probably have. So I'm asking you, it's unique that the moon always shows the same face to the Earth. There's only one possibility of that happening. And I wonder if you thought about how that shaped you know, people's thought down here on Earth. I know that the flat earther is probably if the moon rotated more frequently and we knew that it was spherical or round, that they might have thought that about the Earth a long time ago. I don't know why God did that, but it's unique, and I just wondered what you think about it.
Actually, it's not unique. Many of the satellites in the solar system, I think all of them actually, that we've actually studied up close, they do the same thing. They keep one face towards the planet they orbit at all times. Now, the general explanation, and I alluded to this earlier in our discussion today, is that it's a tidal interaction, but it takes time to do that. And I don't think in the biblical time frame that we have enough time for that to account. So as a creationist, I have to come up with some other explanation. I do believe. I think God made the moon that way, made the other satellites that way. Well, why did he do that? I don't know. And that's one of the things I think about a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think you're onto something here. Caller's name again was?
Doug.
Doug, yeah. Doug, I think you're onto something here, and I've been thinking about it. I do believe there's a design aspect here. Just because I don't know what it is and nobody knows what it is doesn't mean there isn't one. Just means we haven't figured it out yet. So you've raised a very good question, one I've thought about many times and I continue to think about. And one of these days, maybe we'll get an answer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Doug.
Could I ask you another one?
Sure.
Okay. You know, the equation for gravitational attraction between bodies, you know, the GMM over R squared.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as the masses get closer together, the number for the attraction increases. And I'm wondering if you think that, you know, plans that people have to go and mine their moon or, I don't know, dump our sewage on the moon or whatever they're planning to do or hoping to do in the future, I'm wondering if that might affect the moon in ways that we end up not being able to control.
Oh, no, the mass of the moon is huge. It's something like 10 to the 22nd kilograms, I think. That's like 10 to the 21st tons.
Wow.
I mean, that's a staggering large number. So if we removed even, you know, a million tons or took a million tons there, it really wouldn't affect the mass significantly at all. So that's not a problem.
Thank you, Doug, for the call. Our number to Crosstalk, 800-733-9829. Mark is our next caller. Go ahead, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, I have a question about people who call us, we have a flat Earth. How can they possibly call us a flat Earth when they've seen us from space?
Well, they deny the pictures.
My experience with flat earthers is that they deny that we've ever been into space. I mean, if the Earth is flat with a dome over top, then nothing can orbit the Earth. The moon doesn't, satellites don't, and so NASA and the astronauts have been lying about everything.
Hmm.
That's their argument. It doesn't make any sense to me, but that's their argument.
Even astronauts have been believers in Christ. They're saying that they are liars as well.
Exactly.
Wow. Our number here, 800-733-9829, and I see we're just seconds from the break, so Brian, you hang on from Cambridge, Minnesota. You'll be our next caller. Dr. Danny Faulkner with us here today on the broadcast. Reminder that he is speaking this evening. 6 o'clock, doors open. 7 o'clock, he'll be addressing the group, Fox River Christian Church. That's on Lonsdale Road in Waukesha, free admission, and then an observation of the heavens afterwards with hopes to see a couple planets there in space as well. And back in just a minute here on Crosstalk on VCY America.
For the Worldview Week in Minute, I'm Brandon Hausch. Our website's worldviewradio.com. Americans must identify the enemy if we have any chance of self-defense or even victory. And many Americans have no idea that the greatest enemies of our nation have changed their name and infiltrated some of the most powerful institutions in America at the level of politics, economics, and religion. One such group is Hamas. They were started in the 1980s. They're a terrorist organization, no doubt about it. connected to Muslim Brotherhood, which was involved in the final Holocaust. And my friends, they hide under many names in America. CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, and many others. If we do not understand who the enemy is, what their name is, if we cannot identify them, we cannot defeat them, much less defend ourselves against their attacks. This is exactly what my docu-movie Sabotage is all about. Americans had better wake up.
Dr. Danny Faulkner with us today. Just a reminder, his book, The Expanse of Heaven, Where Creation and Astronomy Intersect, it's available through the VCY bookstore. And again, normally $24.99 for a limited time. You can get it for $19 at the bookstore. You do need to call, though, 1-888-722-4829. 1-888-722-4829. Back to the phone lines. We have Brian calling in from Cambridge, Minnesota. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hey, all right. First-time caller, long-time listener. I love the topic. I'm going to get a book when I'm done talking. I just have a question for you, Doc. Is it true that on the light side of the moon, it's 150 degrees, and on the dark side, it's 150 below? Is that right?
Those numbers sound approximately correct to me. It changes temperature by a few hundred degrees from day to night. It takes 2 weeks to do that, though.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
All right.
David is calling next from Mesa, Arizona. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I joined the conversation a little late, and you had mentioned that the effects on the tides are twice as stronger from the moon than the sun. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes, you did.
Okay, the reason I'm asking is I was teaching physics, and we had a worksheet where it showed how the size of an object drops off by a rate of 1 over r squared. So if you take something twice as far away, it drops off as 1/4 the size. And similarly, gravitation, the force of gravitation, also drops off as 1 over r squared. So when I was teaching that, I came to the realization for the first time that if two objects of the same density appear the same size in the sky, that they would have the same gravitational effect. Wouldn't that be true?
Yes, that would be true.
Okay, so I would think the sun would be more dense than the moon, and therefore the greater density would cause the sun to have a greater impact on
the
sky.
They're not the same size, though. The moon is the sun is 400 times larger. And
but they appear the same size, just like their size drops off as 1 over r.
All right, I would have to sit down and cogitate that on for a minute here, and I don't have time. But one thing I want to do mention, though, is that the tidal, the gravitational force is inverse square of the distance, but the tidal force is inverse cube of the distance. You get the tidal force by taking the differential of the gravity. When you take that differential, you end up increasing the second power to the third power in the denominator. And that's the reason why the tidal force is greater.
That explains it then. I was thinking of just the gravitational force, which I thought was over r squared.
Yep.
But I see the point. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. And taking your calls here at Crosstalk, I just lost a caller here, number 800-733-9829. That's 800-733-9829. Let's go to Brad, who's calling in next. Brad, you're on the air.
Hi, Jim. I got a question. Do these people that advocate for a flat Earth ever tell us how thick they think the Earth pancake is?
No. That's one of my complaints with the flat Earth movement, is that so few of them ever want to get down to specifics of their model. They often won't, usually won't tell you how wide the Earth is from edge to edge. They won't tell you how high the dome is over the Earth. They won't tell you how far away the sun and the moon are. They're pretty certain about a lot of things that they don't believe, but they're very hazy about anything they do believe.
Well, you know what? It would have to be pretty thick, even to the point of being, it couldn't be a pancake. It would have to be more of a cylinder in order to have the mass to create the gravity we have.
Oh, boy. Well, they don't believe in gravity.
What do they think is holding them here?
Well, they argue the two different camps. One is that it's all due to buoyancy, which tells me they don't understand anything about the physics of buoyancy. The other thing they try to argue is that it's an effect of electromagnetism. when they say they don't believe gravity, what they don't mean that the things don't fall when you drop them. What they mean is they don't believe in any of the theories of gravity we have, such as Newton's theory of gravity. That's complete hokum, according to them. It's some other effect.
Well, we know Jesus holds all things together by the word of his power.
Mm. That's correct.
Amen. Thank you, Brad.
Thank you.
Ed in Newark, Ohio, you're on the air.
Yes, just a couple of observations. I'm a Christian, and I watched that documentary that he was talking about, a funny thing happened on the way to the moon. And what I'm wondering is what do they do about the Van Allen belt? Because they talked about the moon, you know, about the guys walking out there in Gemini program and all that. And then also the next to last shuttle, which ever went up, and they had to get closer to the Earth. They were 400 miles out, and the astronauts complained of radiation in the helmets and blacking out or whatever. And I was just kind of wondering, and then the last thing I saw, and then I'll hang up and listen on radio, was the situation, I'm trying to think here real quick now. One of the astronauts that was up in the International Space Station said, we're hoping before long to get out of low Earth orbit. I thought we got out of low Earth orbit when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon.
All right, several questions there. The Van Allen belts are greatly misunderstood. They're these donut-shaped belts of charged particles orbiting around the sun. They're trapped by the magnetic field. Most of those particles coming from the sun, and the magnetic field deflects and protects the Earth from those charged particles. And it really commences in earnest well above low Earth orbit. It's a few thousand miles up, which all of the space station and the shuttle, they all orbit below that. However, getting to the moon, you had to go through the Van Allen belt, and they had three things that really protected the astronauts. One is they didn't just blast straight outward from the near the equator of the Earth heading towards the moon. Instead, they launched up a bit or down a bit, and they went over the Van Allen belt. They intentionally did that because, remember, they're donut shapes, and if you kind of hop up, you can get over most of that. Number two, they were traveling very fast when they launched it from the Earth to go to the moon. It's 25,000 miles per hour, and they went through that thin part of the belt pretty quickly. And number three, the thin skin, the metal skin of the spacecraft did protect them to some level, particularly the command module was thicker than the one on the lunar excursion module. Many people misunderstand. They think the radiation's deadly. It's not. And we're worried today about it because we have a different society today.
Thank you for the call. We're out of time. Dr. Danny Faulkner is our guest. If you're in southeast Wisconsin, you can hear him this evening. Fox River Christian Church, located in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Event starts at 6 o'clock. He'll be doing a presentation at 7, a telescope viewing about 9 o'clock this evening. Dr. Faulkner, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And check out more at creationresearch.org. And also answersingenesis.org, and more about him and his background and writings as well. And don't forget to obtain a copy of his book. Call the VCY Bookstore, 1-888-722-4829. Thanks for joining us today on Crosstalk.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the Internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208, or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.